Hi, this is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and I welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. We are in part 9 of our 9-part series on the 8 final prophecies of Jesus in the book of Luke. And I want to wrap up this series this week with Luke's 5th prophecy in Luke 17. We didn't really talk about it in detail. I wanted to save the latter half of that prophecy for today. But if you'll go back to part 5, you can catch the first part of this prophecy, and then we'll finish up. And I want to warn you as well. This 9th part is probably going to be about, when I look at it, about twice as long as any of the other 8 parts that have preceded this one. But I want to promise you it's worth listening to. Let's start with actually reading the passage, Luke 17, 22 through 37. It says, "Then he said to the disciples, 'The days are coming when you will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. They will say to you, "Look there," or "Look here." Do not go. Do not set off in pursuit, for as the lightning flashes and lights up the sky from one side to the other, so will the Son of Man be in his day. But first he must endure much suffering and be rejected by this generation. And just as it was in the days of Noah, so too it will be in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage, until the day Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed all of them. Likewise, just as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building. But on the day that Lot left Sodom, it rained fire and sulfur from heaven and destroyed all of them. It will be like that on the day that the Son of Man is revealed. On that day, anyone on the housetop who has belongings in the house must not come down to take them away. And likewise, anyone in the field must not turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Those who try to make their life secure will lose it. Those who lose their life will keep it. I tell you, on that night, there will be 2 in one bed. One will be taken and the other left. There will be 2 women grinding meal together. One will be taken and the other left." Then they asked him, "Where, Lord?" And he said to them, "Where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather." What must be kept in mind this week as we go through this passage is just like as in Matthew 5 through 7, you find the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew's gospel, being given by Jesus to his disciples. But in Luke 6, you find that it's a sermon on the plain that Jesus is actually giving to the people. So this Olivet discourse that in Matthew 24 is given to the disciples, in Luke is a temple discourse. In Luke's gospel, it comes from 2 different sections. One is in Luke 21, where it's given to the people in the temple. And also Luke 17 that we're looking at this week, where Jesus is speaking both to a Pharisee and to his disciples. And where I believe the majority of modern commentators run into problems is that they try to force Luke 21, Luke 17, as well as Matthew 24, into either being primarily about the destruction of Jerusalem or primarily about the second coming. And it is primarily about neither, but really... It's about the coming of the nonviolent kingdom or the reign of Christ on earth as it is in heaven. And I want to give 2 quick words to that for both audiences. I want the second audience to know that from the very beginning of this week, I believe in a literal second coming of Jesus that is still future. But what I'm saying is that some of the passages in the Gospels that traditionally have been interpreted as Jesus speaking of his second coming really aren't talking about Jesus' second coming, but the coming of the Baranasha, the Son of Man and the new community that's centered in him, and it's rooted in Jesus' understanding of Daniel 7, and 13 and 14, and the establishment of Christ's kingdom. That's what it's talking about. In other words, the second coming and the establishment of Christ's kingdom are not necessarily the same event in the Gospels. The disciples really didn't have a clue that Jesus was going to die the first time, much less that he would leave and come back. Their focus is on how Christ's kingdom is going to be established, how Jesus came in that moment, in that time, that era, to establish his kingdom. And Christ's kingdom, according to Jesus, was actually established on this earth through his death and resurrection, through the events of his first coming, although his kingdom today is in its still in its obstructed form. Also, to that first audience, talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, which actually was the result of Judaism's rejection of the nonviolent kingdom of the Messiah and the possibility of a nonviolent reign. Their choice of a violent militaristic revolution against Rome, instead of embracing the way of peace taught by Jesus, was what produced the destruction of Jerusalem. And it would now be part of the history that would surround the coming of Christ's nonviolent enemy-embracing kingdom. But what I'm trying to say is this. Certain pieces of these passages may refer to the destruction of Jerusalem in so much as it plays a part of the overall scheme of the prophecies. But these prophecies are not primarily about the destruction of Jerusalem, but just like with the second coming, they're primarily about the coming of Christ's nonviolent reign on earth. And this will become clear as we progress through this passage. Let's start to unpack this passage. We're going to take it one section at a time, and keep in mind the problems that arise when we try to make these words primarily about either the second coming or the destruction of Jerusalem. And keep in mind that it's rather about how Christ and his nonviolent kingdom on earth is going to be established. The first section is, "Then he said to his disciples, 'The days are coming when you will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it.'" Now, within the cultural context of Jesus's message of nonviolent enemy-embracing, enemy love and forgiveness, there was a document highly regarded by the Pharisees entitled The Rule of the Messiah or The Rule of the Congregation, depending on which source you're looking at. Both titles refer to the same document. And the coming of the Messiah and the establishment of the kingdom of the Son of Man, as they understood it in Daniel 7, 13 and 14, according to this document, would be ushered in by a violent war between the Messiah and Israel's enemies, and Jerusalem would be established through the violent destruction of Jerusalem's enemies. Where Jesus uses the phrase, "the days of the Son of Man," of which the disciples would long for, Jesus is referring to the contemporary belief surrounding how they believed the kingdom of the Son of Man would be established. Jesus clearly says that a coming of the Son of Man that looks like the rule of the Messiah, how the rule of the Messiah, that document portrayed it, they wouldn't see it. They would long to see it, but they wouldn't see it. It won't be happening like that at all. On the contrary, because of Jerusalem's rejection of a nonviolent Messiah in favor of a violent one, Jerusalem would now be the victim of destruction at the hands of their enemies rather than the other way around. And this was a blatant contradiction to the contemporary beliefs of how the kingdom of the Son of Man would come as it was presented in the rule of the Messiah. And to give you a taste of how this document reads, after the mass destruction of Jerusalem's enemies, there's a banquet spoken of that the Messiah holds. And the document reads this: "At a session of the men of renown, those summoned to the gathering of the community council, when God begets the Messiah with them, the chief priests of all the congregation of Israel shall enter, and all his brothers, and the sons of Aaron, and the priests summoned to the assembly, the men of renown, and they shall sit before him, each one according to his dignity. After Messiah," and remember this is a warlord Messiah, a violent Messiah, "after the Messiah of Israel shall enter, and before him shall sit the heads of the thousands of Israel, each one according to his dignity, according to his position in their camps, and according to their marches." This was their battle encampments and their war marches. "And when they gather at the table of community or to drink the new wine, and the table of the community is prepared, and the new wine is mixed for drinking, no one should stretch out his hand to the first fruit of the bread or of the new wine before the priest. For he is the one who blesses the first fruit of the bread and the new wine and stretches out his hand towards the bread before them. Afterwards, the Messiah of Israel shall stretch out his hands towards the bread, and afterwards they shall bless all the congregation of the community, each one according to his dignity. And in accordance with this precept, one shall act at each meal when at least 10 men are gathered." Now, in this document, this portrayal of how the kingdom of the Son of Man would be ushered in, and this great banquet that would be held after this mass destruction, Jesus is repeatedly contradicts this document. You can find him attacking this document in Luke 14. You can find it in Jesus' Last Supper in Luke 22. He actually takes the imagery of this document with the wine and the bread and he ushers in a nonviolent kingdom. But the comparison, really in detail, would have to be done in another podcast or another e-site. But you can Google the reign of the Son of Man, or the rule of the Messiah, sorry, and the rule of the congregation. You can Google those and read that document for yourself. What Jesus is sharing in this passage in Luke 17 is that not only will Jesus' kingdom not be established with this type of violence, but because of Jerusalem's rejection of Jesus' enemy love, enemy forgiveness, enemy embracing, and nonviolence, Jerusalem's future now lies on the path of her own destruction at the hands of her enemies, rather than her enemies being destroyed by the Messiah. And this next section, I think, makes it clear. They will say to you, look here or look there. Do not go. Do not set in pursuit. And you can go back to part five and take a look at this again. We treat this phrase in detail in part five. But suffice it to say here that Jesus is saying his kingdom will not come through the violent insurrection of wiping out Rome according to the way that the enemies of Israel would be destroyed in the rule of the Messiah. Instead, Rome would destroy Jerusalem, and this was the exact opposite of what Jesus' contemporaries were expecting. He goes on to say, "For as lightning flashes and lights up the sky from one side to the other, so will the Son of Man be in his day." And Jesus here is saying that the kingdom of the Son of Man, rooted in Daniel 7, 13 and 14, it's not going to come the way the rule of the Messiah had spoken, but rather it would be as a light in the heavens, lighting up the dark night sky from as far as the east to the west. It would be radically more inclusive than they had understood or were even willing to embrace. It would bring together both east and west. It would not destroy, per se, the west in favor of the east or destroy the east in favor of the west. No, it would include the whole gamut and illuminate the night sky of the entire region, of both regions. It would include those in the east as those in the west, as a light to bring both reconciliation, restoration, and healing. And then Jesus goes on to say this phrase, "But first he must endure much suffering and be rejected by this generation." And Jesus clearly here is putting his cards on the table, saying that he believes that they are set on a course of rejection, and that they would reject him and his way of nonviolence. And that's extremely insightful when you look at the next passage, because as they were expecting the coming of the Son of Man to bring the restoration of Israel and the destruction of Israel's enemies, instead, the coming of the Son of Man, because of their rejection of him, history is going to play out very differently than what they expected. He goes on to say, "Just as it was in the days of Noah, so too it will be in the days of the Son of Man." In other words, it's not going to come like you expected. It's going to be like Noah. "They were eating and drinking, marrying and being given in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed all of them. Likewise, just as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building. But on the day that Lot left Sodom, it rained fire and sulfur from heaven and destroyed them all. And it will be like that on the day that the Son of Man is revealed." And the parallels here are just stunning that Jesus is making. Noah had, number one, he had preached of a coming destruction. Number two, of a way of preventing that destruction. And number three, he was rejected by his generation, which, number four, led to that generation's destruction. Jesus is following the same exact pattern. This is what the coming of the Son of Man is going to look like for Israel. The Son of Man had come, warning of a coming destruction upon Jerusalem if they continued on their current path of an eye for an eye, retaliation, and violence towards their enemies. And Jesus had, number two, presented a way to prevent that destruction through embracing his narrow path, his entering through the narrow gate of doing unto others as you would have them do to you, of nonviolence, of enemy embracing, enemy love and forgiveness. And Jesus, number three, just like Noah, was being rejected by his generation. And number four, this rejection would also end in the generation of Jesus' day being annihilated, not by a physical, H2O kind of flood, but by the flood of a Roman army. And the parallels between the days of Lot and Jesus' ministry are just as stunning too. Jesus, like the messengers that came to Sodom and Gomorrah in Lot's day, Jesus had come to Jerusalem warning of a coming destruction. Jesus was bringing a way of escape from that destruction through abandoning the eye for an eye way of retribution and retaliation and embracing instead his path of nonviolent enemy love. But just as with Sodom and Gomorrah, because of the violence, as a result of the path of the violence that Jerusalem was on, a fiery destruction was now in Jerusalem's future too. And Jerusalem would see too late. She would become aware too late. It would be revealed to her in the midst of a fiery destruction that Jesus was right. There is a violent path that seems right to mankind. We still believe that we must return evil with more evil. But for Jerusalem, it will be revealed to be truly Jesus's way of peace is the way of life. And Jerusalem's reluctance to let go of violence would end in her going up in smoke. And to use Old Testament imagery, it would be a smoke that would ascend forever and ever. And Jesus goes on to say, on that day, anyone on the housetop who has belongings in the house must not come down to, and I'm going to read from the Greek, to take them back. Likewise, anyone in the field must not turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Those who try to make their life secure will lose it. Those who lose their life will keep it. This passage so closely relates to Jesus' words in Luke 9:23 that it's amazing to me that so many scholars have missed it. In Luke 9, Jesus says to his disciples, "If any of you want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross daily, and follow me. And for those who want to save their life will lose it. Those who want to who lose their life for my sake will save it." And this is another clear case of where today you'll have those who see in this primarily the destruction of Jerusalem, as well as those who argue for a primary application of the second coming. And I'm submitting that it's primarily about neither, but rather it's about two paths. And we have those two paths continually being laid before us in each of Jesus' eight prophecies, his final prophecies concerning Jerusalem in the Gospel of Luke. Remember, as we've gone through each one of these, the choice was nonviolence or non-existence. It was a choice between two paths. Number one, nonviolent, enemy embracing, enemy forgiving, enemy love, or number two, an eye for an eye, retaliation, a retribution, violent resistance against the Romans. Luke's use of these words of Jesus is unmistakable. It's the same words from Luke chapter 9, verse 23. To come down off the rooftop and to take back one's belongings that are being threatened, to try and resist Roman invasion through violent insurrection. The words Jesus uses here for those who come down to take them back is the Greek word ero. And it is the same word used by Jesus in his Sermon on the Plain in Luke 6. He says, "But I say unto you, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away," this is ero, "your coat, don't withhold your shirt either. Give to everyone who begs from you. And if anyone takes away your goods," there's that word ero again, "do not ask for them back. Do to others as you would have them do to you." Jesus in Luke 17 is warning of a time when Rome would come in and arrow the possessions, take the possessions of the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And even then, Jesus was saying that the kingdom response would not be to arrow or to take their possessions back through violent insurrection, to fight to make it secure, to fight to protect their goods from being taken by the Romans. The kingdom response would be to turn the other cheek, to love, and to turn those possessions that were being threatened, the loss of which was being threatened, into a gift. You can think of Victor Hugo's priest in Les Miserables, who instead of taking back, instead of arrow the candlesticks that Jean Valjean had stolen, he simply gave them to him as a gift, thus bringing radical transformation in the heart of this thief. And to come down off the rooftop and to take back one's goods, or to be out in the field and to turn back to try and fight against Roman soldiers through violent retaliation and endeavor to save one's life and to try and make their life secure through violent means against the threat of, violence from Rome. This would be the exact opposite of what Jesus had been saying ever since Luke 6, to be willing to let go of Jewish pride, of a vision of the kingdom that was rooted in the destruction of Jerusalem's enemies rather than the reconciliation of, Jerusalem's enemies, to seek the eternal welfare of, Romans over and above making even their own life secure, to abandon their tribal nationalism of Judaism in favor of even losing one's life if need be for the coming of the nonviolent, enemy-embracing kingdom of the Son of Man. This is what it means to choose between taking goods back or, turning back to violently protect your possessions and instead learning the way of, nonviolent non-cooperation. Jesus equates the path of violent retaliation against Roman attack as akin to when Lot's wife turned back to try and save her possessions from destruction. And just as it ended in her death, it would end in Jerusalem's death as well. Jesus then drives the point home. He says, "I tell you, on that night, there will be two in one bed. One will be taken, the other left. There will be two women grinding meal. One will be taken, the other left." From the beginning, Jesus had been contrasting these two paths, the narrow path of nonviolent non-cooperation, which will create a whole new world, and the wide path of violent retaliation, which leaves the whole world blindly escalating towards annihilation. And here Jesus personifies each option by two in bed and two grinding meal. The one who chooses the path of violence will be taken away, while the other one who chooses nonviolence will be left. The one who seeks to make their life secure will be taken, and those who are willing to, lose their life will be left. Those who choose the path of, nonviolent non-cooperation, those who are willing to follow Jesus would keep their life, is what Jesus was saying. And then it goes on to say, the last section, it says, "Then they asked him, 'Where, Lord?' And he said to them, 'Where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather.'" Jesus' answer here is most likely the one phrase in this entire passage that would have created the greatest paradigm shift and his entire audience's heart and mind as they listened. "Where the corpse is, there the vultures will be gathered." Jesus is here referring to Ezekiel's prophecy in Ezekiel 39, and he's combining it with Isaiah's prophecy in Isaiah 25, and he's contrasting it with that document we referred to earlier of the rule of the Messiah or the rule of the congregation. And the space doesn't permit us this week. We're already at 24 minutes, I think, right now, somewhere around that ballpark. So time and space don't permit me to quote Ezekiel 39 at length or Isaiah 25 at length. But I want you to go back and read each one of these sections for yourself this week. Ezekiel 39 is a prophecy where Israel will be restored while Israel's enemies are destroyed. And in verses 17 and 19 of that chapter, Ezekiel prophesies, "As for you, mortal, thus says the Lord God, speak to the birds of every kind and to all the wild animals. Assemble and come and gather from all around to the sacrificial feast that I'm preparing for you, a great sacrificial feast on the mountains of Israel. And you shall eat flesh and drink blood. You shall eat the flesh of the mighty. You shall drink the blood of the princes of the earth, of rams, of lambs, of goats, and bulls, of all of them, of the fatlings of Bashan." Ezekiel here is likening all these warlords and their armies to the sacrificial animals. He says, "You shall eat fat until you are filled, drink blood until you are drunk at the sacrificial feast that I'm preparing for you. You shall be filled at my table with war horses and battle chariots and warriors and all kinds of soldiers, says the Lord God." What Jesus is doing here, I think, is nothing short of amazing. He's taking Ezekiel's prophecy concerning the fate of Israel's enemies, and he's turning it on its head. You can find this principle in Jeremiah 18 again, 5 through 10. We've already looked at that in this series. But he's now using Ezekiel's original imagery that prophesied of what would happen to Israel's enemies. And Jesus is taking it and applying that imagery to Israel herself and what she's going to experience instead at the hands of her enemies because of her failure to forsake violence and embrace the nonviolence of Jesus as their messianic hope. Just as the pagan empires had trusted in warlords and soldiers and warriors and battle charioteers and war horses, and they would become a sacrifice, they would be slain on the battlefield. Jesus is saying, so Israel now, who also trusts in those, will be slain in the same way, where the vultures will gather to feast on their corpses. And just stop and think about that. Isaiah had prophesied in Isaiah 25, he had said, on this mountain the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, of rich foods filled with marrow and well-aged wine strained and clear. He will destroy on this mountain all the shroud that is cast over all peoples and the sheet that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. Then the Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces, and the disgrace of his people will be taken away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. It will be said on that day, lo, this is our God. We have waited for him. So that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation, for the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain. This is what Isaiah had prophesied of Jerusalem, that Jerusalem would be restored and it would bring about the conversion of the nations to the following of Yahweh. And Isaiah had prophesied of a restoration that, make sure you notice this, it included all peoples of every nation, kindred, and tongue. And those of Jesus' day would rather embrace an eschatology rooted in the rule of the Messiah or the rule of the congregation, which spoke of Israel's enemies being annihilated by the Messiah, of leaving only the Jewish nation itself. And Jesus is combining both of these prophecies of Ezekiel's and Isaiah's alongside of the banquet prophecy of the rule of the Messiah. And then he gives his final blow. He says, there the vultures will gather. And the word here, as attested by many scholars for vulture, could also just as easily be translated eagle instead. Eagles were a scavenger just as much as vultures were, and this word can go either way. And it's interesting that Rome's national symbol was the eagle, and surely the eagles of Rome would soon be circling Jerusalem if they continued to refuse Jesus' path of nonviolent enemy love. Luke continues the context. His context actually confirms how we've interpreted this passage. In Luke 18, Jesus gives the parable of the unjust judge, which was the situation that they lived in that day, refusing to be moved. And Jesus is giving it that for those who would feel that Jesus' way of nonviolence doesn't seem to be working. He was telling them they should not give up, but they should keep praying and keep loving their enemies. And then Luke has Jesus contrasting once again those two paths, the narrow path that leads to life and the wide path that leads to death, violence versus nonviolence, the two in bed and the two grinding at grain. Luke goes on to contrast immediately two who went to the temple to pray. And what's deeply profound is that Jesus places the Pharisees, who consider themselves more favored by God than anyone else, as morally superior to everyone else. He places them in the category of the ones who are going to be taken in Luke 17, while the Jewish tax collector who sought the path of mercy, he places him in the category of those who would be left. There's a lot to ponder in this passage for sure. The heart group application this week, number one, I want you to actually take the time each day to go back over each one of the eight prophecies and dedicate a portion of your day. It doesn't have to be very long, but just some time each day to prayerfully contemplating what it meant for Jesus' audience and what each one of these prophecies could mean for us today. Number two, I want you to keep notes of any insights that you receive as you go through this. And number three, just be prepared to share those insights with your heart group this upcoming week, whatever Jesus gives you to share. In Luke 17:6, Luke records the words of Jesus. The Lord replied, "If you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it would obey you." And the mulberry tree was over 20 feet tall, but just something as small as a mustard seed, Jesus was saying, could uproot it, according to Jesus. And what was basically this nonviolent path that was seemingly insignificant, how could this small means accomplish such a significant task? And Jesus is clearly giving them this imagery, faith in his teachings on enemy love, enemy forgiveness, nonviolence, enemy embracing, nonviolent non-cooperation, to follow this path, to believe that this could actually change the world, is the to believe that it's the means whereby which Jesus' kingdom can be established. That's what it means to practice a mustard seed-like faith with mustard seed qualities. Remember, the mustard seed was a weed that would take over the entire garden if it wasn't uprooted. And Jesus also said in this passage this week, "For the as lightning flashes and lights up the sky from one side to the other, so will the Son of Man be in his day." It would not look the way that they expected it to. Today, our world is enveloped in the darkness of violence, and we need to remember that the darkest part of the night, what seems to be the darkest night part of the night, is always said to be just before the dawn. Christ's nonviolent kingdom will light up the dark night sky from the east to the west. It will show us a better way, and it's the way that leads to life. I want to close this entire series with the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and these words I believe are appropriate to our series. In the Gospel Messenger, 1958, King's article read this way: "Evil may so shape events that Caesar will occupy a place and Christ a cross. But the same Christ arose and split history into AD and BC, so that even the life of Caesar must be dated by his name. Yes, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. There is something in the universe which justifies William Cullen Bryant in saying, 'Truth crushed to the earth will rise again.'" This is the same hope given to us in Jesus' Sermon on the Plain and repeated throughout the final eight prophecies of Jesus concerning Jerusalem in the Gospel of Luke. Over and over again, we find the reality that, according to Luke and Luke's version of the Jesus story, the kingdom has come. It is among us. Christ's way of nonviolent non-cooperation, combined with truth and enemy love, places the means of significant world change, of healing, restoration, reconciliation. It places all of that in the hands of each one of us, collectively and individually. And may the world of enemy-inclusive forgiveness and love continue to grow through us each and every day. We are not, as a human race, irrevocably fated for non-existence. We can choose the path of nonviolence and love, till the only world that remains is a world where enemy-embracing, enemy-forgiving, and enemy-loving, nonviolent love reigns. I love you guys. Thanks for hanging in with me this week. We'll see you next week.